a book which has been widely read and widely commented on in recent months has been the Status Seekers by Vance Packard. The Status Seekers. The main thesis of this book is that far from eliminating class distinctions in our democratic society, there is a definite trend towards class differentiation and the hardening of class lines in our national life. Straining after status has intensified among our people. The American people, in spite of its great material abundance, which is being progressively more widely diffused, therefore should normally tend to the obliteration of sharp and angular class distinctions. The American people, nevertheless, is not moving in the direction of a classless society, but away from it. Away from it towards a national class structure in which there is a variety of status systems. There is increasing social cleavage and stratification. Americans are being rated, and in return are rating other Americans, upgrading them or downgrading them as groups of people, not on the basis of merit or character or achievement, but on the basis of the neighborhood in which they live, the people they associate with, the club they belong to, or even the church with which they are affiliated. Because these are, or have come to be regarded, as status symbols. And they may prove, if you're not careful, they may prove barriers to men and women who are climbing the social ladder. And more our people are straining to surround themselves with the proper status symbols, the symbols which will give them the proper rating and so admit them into the coveted circle of the elect. We've had in this country, according to the author, a two-dimensional class system, one of horizontal levels based upon wealth, job, education, style of life, and the other is sort of a vertical system based on ethnic differentiation, on racial differentiation, and religious differentiation. The author writes, our class system is starting to bear a resemblance to that which prevails in the military services. In the services, there are, of course, status differences between a private and a corporal, and between a lieutenant and a captain. But the great division is between officers and enlisted men, with only quite limited opportunities for acquiring, while in service, the training necessary to pass from one division to the other. And so the author says, the system of horizontal social strata, which I perceive emerging in America, is in two great divisions. And within each division, there are classes, of course, or major bulges. But here appears to be the most graphic way to suggest the generalization, the situation that is developing. And so the author finds two major classes, as it were, within the system of horizontal levels of distinction, stratification. The one he calls the diploma elite, and that is composed of the real upper class and the semi-upper class, and then the supporting classes. And these are the limited success class, the working class, and finally the real lower class. Now the first group, the diploma elite, consists of the big, active, successful people who pretty much run things in the community. The supporting classes, the second group, contain the passive, non-big people who wear both white and blue collars, the small shopkeepers, the workers, functionaries, technical aides. Now, in the diploma elite, he finds, first of all, the real upper class. And these are the people who are likely to be on the board of directors of local industries, banks, universities, community chests, who send their daughters to finishing schools and their sons probably to a boarding school and certainly to a good college. And they have heavy investments in local land, industry, banks. They probably inherit much of it. And they can swing a great deal of weight around town when they wish. These also include the high-prestige professionals, such as the more fashionable doctors, lawyers, architects, who come from well-connected families or have an upper-class clientele. The Episcopal minister also would normally be included here. And that's the real upper class in any given American community, according to the author. Now the semi-upper class, in this top bracket, is composed mostly of members who are mostly confident, energetic, ambitious people who went away to college, then began a career somewhere away from their home, town, or neighborhood. Most of them are with fairly large organizations, where they are decision makers, serving as managers and technologists or persuaders, and the remainder are professional men or successful local businessmen. Now, members of this semi-upper class are the hyperactive civic boosters who devote themselves actively to their roles in service clubs and country clubs, and their wives power the local charity drives. Now, these two classes constitute what he calls the diploma elite. Now, between the two classes, that is, between the diploma elite and the supporting classes, is a gulf. Beyond the gulf are the supporting classes. And among these supporting classes comes first the limited success class, Its members place great store in demonstrating that they are respectable, proper, cultured, and socially above the working masses. They are more conforming, more morally proper, and more active in the churches than any other group. To pursue the military parallel, they are the non-commissioned officers of our society. And virtually all its members have high school diplomas. Many of them have a year or two of post-high school training in technical schools, two-year colleges, or secretarial schools. And in offices, they are the clerks, excepting the routine machine attendants and secretaries. In short, they include the lower ranks of the genuinely white-collar world and the higher ranks of the blue-collar world, the aristocrats of labor. Both groups are success-minded, but in a different way. The blue-collared elite at the top of their ladder, and they don't worry too much about trying to upgrade themselves socially by their choice of status symbols. But the white-collared people in this category do worry and do strive. They feel that they haven't arrived and wonder if they ever will. They are constantly striving to get ahead, yet most will never get very far, and after they have outlived the romantic dreams of youth, they know it. And then comes, in this second category, the working class. The heads of families of this class frequently have not finished high school. They work steadily good times, the jobs that require little training, can be mastered in a few days or at most a few weeks. They constitute the backbone of the industrial unions and numerically are the largest class, nearly 40% of the total. And finally, at the lowest rung of this social ladder is the real lower class. They are the people everyone else looks down upon. They live in decrepit slum areas that just about every American town knows. And in parentheses, the author says, slums are much less apparent in European towns and cities. They usually leave school as soon as legally allowed, if not before. They work erratically at unskilled and semi-skilled tasks and try to find their pleasures where they can. And so here you have the five categories in this two-dimensional class system on the horizontal level. And now on the vertical level, you have other categories, divisions, social differentiations. Here they are based on nationality, on race, and on religion. There are minority groups. And there are 50 million Americans who belong to ethnic and religious minority groups against whom certain walls are raised in our society. There are those, for example, who belong to the more recent nationality arrivals, though they didn't come over on the Mayflower. They took the next boat, or a few boats afterwards, came late. They're the more recent arrivals in the community, and they're really not accepted, never accepted by the old-timers, by the older families, who sort of resent the invasion of these upstarts. And interestingly enough, resentment of newcomers seems even more intense at the lower social levels than at the higher social level. Religious lines are drawn in our country. And often there are discriminatory levels within a given religious group. The author says, for example, for whatever reason, whether Gentile barriers, Jewish cohesiveness, or both, Jews do tend to lead a segregated social life. And in many communities, they maintain a division among themselves. The quiet conservative German Jews, the first large Jewish group to reach America, often turn their backs on the more flamboyant and lively Polish and Russian Jews who began arriving several decades later. In some cities, the two groups have their separate elite social clubs. Some cities, not in ours, of course, but in some cities. Catholics, too, tend to split up by national origin. The Irish in some cities remain aloof from the Italians, and the Italians do not intermingle much with the Poles. And Protestants, especially at the elite level, frequently try to draw a line that excludes both Catholics and Jews. Some years ago, one listing of several thousand socially elect New Englanders, this list contained only about a dozen Catholics and still fewer Jews. Now, as far as the Negro in our society is concerned, the author says of him, "For the one American in ten who is a Negro, the boundaries of status are hardly invisible. And to a somewhat lesser extent, the same applies to Americans of Chinese and Mexican or Indian origin. Among Negroes, the color of their skin is almost universally recognized as a barrier to full dignity of treatment from their fellow citizens. Consequently, many of them strain to marry light and tend to grant high status to fellow Negroes who have the lighter complexions." That's stratification by pigmentation, as it were. "While perhaps 10,000 light-skinned Negroes pass the boundary each year and are accepted as white, these constitute but a tiny fraction of their race. Most of the rest must live with the grim fact that while a white person can sometimes work up from a low social status to a high one, a colored man can never work up to being a white man. Many restaurants in the United States which serve the most uncouth white trash would refuse to serve such a distinguished Negro as Dr. Ralph Bunche. A Negro may be a college graduate and an experienced pilot in the U.S. Air Force and yet be rejected as a job applicant by a commercial airline needing pilots. What some can do, what some Negroes can do, however, is to seek to separate themselves as far as possible from the general run of the lower class Negroes through achievement and style of life. And their behavior has become more like that of their opposite class numbers among the whites than like that of the main body of their own people. And the strain of this striving for differentness and superiority is beginning to show. They are more stiff in their behavior and more desperately absorbed in surrounding themselves with status symbols such as limousines and mink coats than their white counterparts. In fact, one of the American sociologists accuses the black bourgeoisie of being engaged in such a wild flight from reality that it is failing to provide responsible leadership for Negroes as a whole. Now, the author devotes considerable space to inquire as to why this straining on the part of the American people for status. reason for it. His conclusions, and I read you a sentence or two, are not very reassuring. This book, he writes, began with an exploration of the class behavior in the United States in this era of unparalleled material abundance. One of the most insistent themes that developed was that status seekers are altering our society by their preoccupation in the midst of plenty with acquiring evidences of status. The people of this country have become increasingly preoccupied with status, primarily because of the impact on their lives of big housing developments, big advertisers, big trade unions, and big corporate hierarchies. As a result, democracy is still more of an ideal than a reality. The forces of the times seem to be conspiring to squeeze individuality and spontaneity from us. We compete for the same symbols of bigness and success. We are careful to conform to the kinds of behavior approved by our peers. We are wary of others who don't look like our kind of people. We tend to judge people by their labels, and all too often we judge people on the basis of the status symbol they display. All this, he says, is hardly a credit to us as a people. We profess to be guided in our attitudes by the body of ideals set forth by our founding fathers, but our founding fathers would wish us to be individualists, free thinkers, independents in mind and spirit. I think, he said, we should all be the happier and live more stimulating lives if we judge people not by the symbols they display and the labels they wear, but rather by their individual worth. In this time, and this is his last sentence of the book, in this time of transcendent challenge and danger to our way of life, it seems clear that we can endure and prevail only if the vast majority of our people really believe in our democratic system. They must be genuinely convinced that our system offers fairer rewards and opportunities for the fulfillment of human aspirations than any other system. Now, my dear friends, the term status seeker is not found in the Bible, nor the term social climber. Not that the people of biblical times did not know these people, the status seekers and the social climbers. They were very well known. Human nature changes very little indeed through the long centuries. But in the Bible, they're called by other names, not any more complimentary, but by other names. The Bible speaks often in condemnation of the proud and the arrogant, of those who push the foot of pride, the regel gaba, of the man of presumption. And over again, our sacred book admonishes us to remember that a man's pride will bring him low, but he who is lowly in spirit will obtain honor. The Bible often speaks of envy, the envy which slays the foolish man, the envy which is rottenness in the bone, rekav עצמות קינה. The last of the Ten Commandments is perhaps the profoundest of all. For of all the commandments, it alone is devoted not so much to outer action, what you should do or should not do, but to inner motives. Lo sachmod, thou shalt not covet. Lo titaveh, thou shalt not lust after things, thy neighbor's house, thy neighbor's field, anything that thy neighbor has, thou shalt not covet. The Bible wants us to be seekers. All men should be seekers. But not seekers after status in the sight of men, but seekers after God and the good life. Dirshuni, seek me, vichyu, and live. Seek God and live. The Bible wants men to climb upward, always to aspire and always to ascend, but to ascend not to some plateau where some silly coterie of self-chosen mortals await them with nothing to offer them but vanity and conceit, but to ascend into the mountain of the Lord and to stand in his holy place with clean hands and a pure heart and a soul which is never lifted up to what is false. Asher lo nasa lashav nafsho. A soul which is never lifted up to what is false. And to such upward climbing, there's no limit. No limit set. This is the only upward climbing which our sacred book recommends. Every other direction is a false direction. And every other form of climbing is only a weariness of the flesh, heartaches, and desolation. When you come to think of it, good friends, no man or no group of men can give you anything that will add an inch to your stature or an ounce to your self-respect and confidence. No man, no group of men can give you anything except truth and perhaps friendship. All else you must achieve by yourself. The more you rely on others for status, for recognition, for social security, the more and more dependent you become on other people, and the less secure, really, you will be within yourself. But men can never take away from you anything that they've not given you. They can't give you anything, really, that you yourself will not achieve. If a man happens to be a small potato, then he remains a small potato, whether it's brown or mashed or French fried. Whether it's in the bin or in a showcase. Nothing can magnify you except yourself for your own efforts in quest of the real things of life. What is important is not how others estimate you. You may think so, but it isn't. But how you estimate yourself, you come to do that honestly and without illusions. What is wrong with status seekers? They place their happiness in the hands of others. Without their coveted coterie, they're lost as individuals. They will suppress themselves, their own independent opinions and judgments, their freedom of soul, in order not to be displeasing to those people whose pleasures, whose approval, they covet, for fear of being rejected by them and cast out of the charmed circle which the status seeker seeks. They will conform when they should rebel. They will be cautious when they should be daring. They will be evasive when they should be forthright. They will be afraid to fail and to risk for fear of losing the status. They will never belong to those who stand on their own feet and speak with their own voices and utter their own convictions. They will never be promulgators. They will never be initiators. They will never set precedents. They may hug to their bosoms a certain haughtiness, but they will never have dignity, nobility, which comes from within and never from without. What's wrong with the social climber? Basically, and at critical moments, the social climber will be a disloyal person. The social climber, I mean the real one, the ardent social climber, is seldom a good friend. He's too eager to get ahead in the world, mindless of whom he leaves behind. The social climber who is determined to get there at all costs, if need be, will deny his background, his ancestry, his people. He will try to rewrite his own history to impress others. All men should be ambitious. No one should stand still. But ambitious for what? So that I may look down on other men? What a contemptible ambition that is. So that I might think myself exclusive, made of better stuff, something rare and choice. No man thrives on exclusiveness. Exclusiveness narrows one's world and constricts one's horizons, and before long, you are left a puffed up little man in a small and colorless world. The word ambition comes from the Latin, ambitio. A going around. Candidates in ancient Rome, candidates for office, used to go around to solicit votes for the office which they sought. Is this the kind of going around you would choose as the supreme enterprise of your life? Soliciting the approval of others, and if you fail of a majority, to regard yourself as having been defeated in life, as having been a failure? Is this ambition worthy of a man? We all love praise, and we all want the esteem of our fellow men. But we should make sure that we deserve it. We all want to succeed. But succeed in what? In the high aims or in the low aims? In being more or just in having more? In being or in seeming to be? Are we striving to excel ourselves or other men? The former may lead to greatness, the latter only to despair. Man to climb over the low rungs within himself to higher and higher levels and purer air and wider vistas. We all want to get to the top, but what do we hope to find there? And how do we hope to get there? By our own efforts? With independence, with pride in ourselves, or by trampling over the lives and the hearts of other people? Ambition. Are you ambitious for yourself alone? What of your family? What of your friends? What of your community, your country? Your world. Are you ambitious to be an exploiter or a co-worker? It's good to make an anatomy of your own ambition. Young Joseph dreamt ambitious dreams. The 11 sheaves bowed down to his sheaf. His 11 brothers. His was to be the upstanding one, the superior one. He dreamt of the sun and the moon and the 11 stars surrounding his star and doing obeisance to him. And so he filled his world with hate and made of his brothers almost fratricides. They were determined to kill him, finally sold him into slavery, and brought sorrow to the heart of his father. Joseph was very ambitious. But it's only after slavery, life in the dungeon, and years of maturity, when his brothers came to Egypt, and when he recognized that the real ambition does not consist in ruling over other people, in using other people, but in helping other people. It's only when Joseph said to his brothers, "Bishuno Eli, come near to me. Bishuno Eli, Ani Yosef Achichem, I am Joseph, your brother." When he embraced them into one great love and one common destiny and one supreme solicitude, that Joseph realized the highest ambition that a man is capable of and became Yosef HaTzadik, Joseph the righteous man. When all is said and done, dear friends, it resolves itself, all this matter of ambition, into a question whether you regard yourself as a debtor of life or a creditor of life. If you regard yourself as a debtor of life, then your ambition will always be to repay. Mo oshiv ladonai kol tagmuloi oloi. How shall I return unto the Lord all the bounty which he has given me? That is how a man speaks, an ambitious man, who feels himself to be indebted to life, for the privilege of life, for the gifts of life, for all the beauty and glory of life. He will be a humble man and try to be a humble servant of his Creator and of the Creator's creation. And he will aspire, of course he will aspire, because all life is aspiration. He will aspire to make himself worthy of life. And he will be among the humble who inherit the earth. That is, if a man thinks of himself as a debtor of life. But if you regard yourself as a creditor of life, that is, a person to whom the world owes something or owes everything, then you will always demand payment on all occasions. You will strive, and sometimes very ruthlessly, to collect, to exploit. You will climb and grasp and pant and climb again until you become great, like Aurelius did, and surpass all who were before him. And then, like Koheleth, you will someday consider all that your hands had done and the toil that you spent in doing it, and behold, it is all vanity and a striving after wind, a striving after wind. That's what status seekers are. Striving after wind. Then the men will come to realize that individual, that while a kingdom was too small for him, perhaps now a grave will suffice. Milton, his Paradise Lost, makes Lucifer say, Lucifer with his consuming passion, craving to climb to heaven, sit himself on the throne of the Almighty. It is better to reign in hell than to serve in heaven. Well, there are those who believe, with the psalmist, that it is better to be a doorkeeper in the house of the Lord than to dwell in the palaces of wickedness. Well, when you make your anatomy of ambition, of your own ambition, whatever it is in life, ask yourself to which of these sentiments you subscribe. Ask yourself whether you regard yourself as a debtor of life or a creditor of life. And you will make the right decision, I'm sure. You will then set out to seek the real goals of life. And the real goals of life are not there
And up there, and with this group of people or that group of people, or in this neighborhood or that neighborhood, or in this club, or in this church or that church, the real goal of life is within your own soul. And you will then not want to seek your satisfactions at the cost of other people's deprivations. You will not enjoy food because other people are hungry. You will not enjoy a warm coat in winter time because other people are shivering. You will not make comparisons. You will not be consumed with competition. You will not be striving after wind. You will be seeking the peace of God in your own soul and in the circle of your own family and your own community. That is ambition that's worthy of a man who is made in the image of God.